Radio Prague News.
The Guardian has reported that the Czechoslovak Communist Secret Service spied on Donald Trump. The suspect in the Petra Kvitova attack has gone on trial and efforts to capture a brown bear pilfering food in the Zlín region continue. US President Donald Trump and his then-wife Ivana were the target of an extensive spying operation conducted by Czechoslovakia's Communist Secret Police, the so-called STB, together with friends from the KGB, The Guardian reported in its Monday edition. According to The Guardian, the STB first opened a file on Trump following his marriage in 1977 to his first wife, Ivana Zelničková, from Czechoslovakia. The operation was run out of Zlín, the provincial town in southwest Czechoslovakia where Zelničková was born and grew up. Ivana's father, Miloš, regularly gave the STB information about his daughter's visits to the US and his celebrity son-in-law's career in New York. Zelničík was classified as a conspiratorial informer, and his relationship reportedly with the STB reportedly lasted until the end of the communist regime. The Guardian says the STB's interest in Donald and Ivana intensified in the late 80s, after Trump let it be known he was thinking of running for president. The suspect in the Petra Kvitova attack has gone on trial at the regional court in Brno. The 33-year-old man is charged with assault over a knife attack in 2016 on the two-time Wimbledon champion. The attacker gained entry into a Brostiov apartment by posing as a maintenance worker. He held a knife to her throat, and in the scuffle to break free, Kvitova suffered deep cuts to her playing left hand. She was rushed to hospital for surgery, and it took her over 5 months to recover. If found guilty, the man could face up to 12 years in jail. Kvitova herself was not present at the hearing. The central bank is likely to increase the basic interest rate to 1.7% at a meeting of the bank's board on Thursday, according to financial experts. The national bank last raised the basic interest rate by a quarter of a percentage point to 1.5% in late September. The board has raised interest rates by 25 basic points at three rate-setting sessions since June, citing economic growth, inflation and wage development. Rangers have set up photo traps to try to locate a brown bear that has been attacking sheep and destroying beehives in mountain villages in the Zlín region. A manual trap with honey set up some time ago proved ineffective. There are now plans to try and sedate the animal with the use of a tranquilizer gun and transport it to a temporary residence at a local zoo. Meanwhile, a zoo in Belgium has expressed interest in taking the bear. And finally, a quick look at the weather forecast. Tuesday should be clear to partly cloudy with day temperatures between 15 and 19 degrees Celsius. I'm Daniela Lazarová, and that's the end of the news. You are listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. Still to come in the program, we look back at the centenary celebrations of the birth of Czechoslovakia, which culminated over the weekend, and then go to Václav Havel Airport, which now employs a friendly robot. Later on in the show, we meet John Tusa, the ex-head of the BBC World Service, was born in Czechoslovakia in 1936 and left the country when his father was made boss of Batya's operations in the United Kingdom. All that coming up, so please stay with us. The Czech Republic capped celebrations of the 100th anniversary of Czechoslovakia's founding on Sunday with a display of fireworks and firepower after a weekend packed full of parades, memorial acts and speeches, concerts, as well as a dazzling video mapping on the facade of the newly renovated National Museum atop Prague's iconic Wenceslas Square. Brian Kennedy reports.
A Let's start with the climax. The fireworks display atop Letná Hill overlooking the historic Prague city centre. It began precisely at 1918 military time, symbolising the year of the birth of Czechoslovakia, and was dominated by the national colours, blue, red and white. The narrated display, under the theme Our Common Century, highlighted the nation's historical and cultural milestones, as well as its natural beauties and sporting achievements, accompanied by excerpts from Czech classics such as Bedřich Smetana's Má vlast. Earlier in the day, the biggest military parade in the country's modern history took place with the appropriate pomp and circumstance. In a unique gesture, it not only included hundreds of professional soldiers from elite Czech units, but also from Slovakia, the UK, France, Italy, and the United States, all NATO allies. From a special tribune, Czech President Miloš Zeman viewed the procession alongside his Slovak counterpart, Andrej Kiska, along with top officials from both countries, members of the diplomatic corps, and visiting foreign dignitaries, such as U.S. Secretary of Defense James Mattis. Despite heavy rain, a flyby of fighter jets and helicopters went ahead, streaking the sky in the national colors as crowds of spectators braved the downpour to cheer on the mighty procession of tanks, armored vehicles, and artillery down Evropská Street, formerly named after Vladimir Lenin. President Zeman and Kiska, paying homage to those who had laid down their lives for the former Czechoslovakia, earlier took part in a wreath-laying ceremony at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier at the Vítkov Memorial, along with their respective prime ministers, Andrej Babiš and Petr Pellegrini. Shortly after, Zeman appointed new army and police generals, and in a ceremony later on Sunday evening at Prague Castle, the Czech president also handed out state distinctions to 41 people, including several generals and a First Republic prime minister honored in memorandum.
Jako výraz úcty k padlým vojákům v Afghánistánu.
President Zeman began his speech by honoring three soldiers killed in Afghanistan this summer, who he said had died fighting terrorists determined to destroy hundreds of years of European civilization, echoing comments he had made earlier at the military parade. Zeman also called on the nation to exemplify the soldiers' courage so they would not have died in vain, and also paid tribute to those who had fought in other ways for the country, such as honoree Lenka Prohaskova, who signed the Charter 77, and former Czechoslovak radio chief Karol Lansky, who kept broadcast going during the Soviet-led invasion of 1968.
Brian Kennedy there reporting on what has been an exciting weekend here in Prague, the celebrations of the centenary of the birth of Czechoslovakia. And we now go to Prague's Václav Havel Airport, where a new employee called Pepper is roaming Terminal 2, offering both directions and entertainment. He is the result of the airport's ongoing adoption of new technologies through its Prague Airport Lab initiative and can be seen as offering a taster of what is yet to come. Tom McEncrow has the details.
Sure, I can dance. Look.
Pepper, Prague Airport's new white robot, is 120 centimetres tall, weighs around 30 kilograms, and can do a straight 12-hour shift before he needs an electricity refill. He rolls on wheels, but has a humanoid shape, able to move his arms and head. His eyes contain cameras, and his feet contain a set of sensors that enable him to identify where and how far away each customer is. More importantly, perhaps, he's the world's first social humanoid robot able to recognize faces and basic human emotions, at least according to his creator, Japanese conglomerate SoftBank. The company has sold around 12,000 multifunctional Pepper model robots since introducing him at a conference in 2014. The airport's spokesman, Roman Bacvoň, explained how the robot can be helpful.
For example, he is giving directions to the nearest information counter or children's play area or your departure gate. It has also entertaining functions. He dances upon request and takes a selfie with passengers. And at the same time, he provides helpful information about Prague Airport or MasterCard services.
He is still a relatively early form of robot assistant, offering a touch screen for any passenger to use in case he does not understand them. However, Pepper's introduction into Prague's international airport serves as a taster for the future technological innovations to come, Mr. Patzfoy said.
The idea is a part of the long-term development plans of the airport, which are ready to be implemented in upcoming years. Within these plans, we are also looking at the distant future, which means that all future projects should have the potential to work and act efficiently even after several decades. Now, for example, we are testing electromobiles or car sharing systems or some technologies to improve check-in process, security technologies and so on.
Passengers flying to countries within the Schengen area are likely to run into Pepper as he is currently roaming the spaces of Terminal 2 from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. every day. The airport is also considering using the robot as a platform through which passengers waiting in queues can purchase a quicker, fast-track security check. Pepper is one of many robots being implemented in various industries in the Czech Republic. In September, Hospodářské noviny reported about a farm which is run entirely by artificial intelligence, while the CEO of Czech food delivery service Rohlík.cz was recently quoted by IT business server Connect.cz as saying that his company will be using robots for food deliveries from 2019.
Bye-bye.
The sound of the humanoid robot Pepper bidding you bye-bye and ending that report by Tom McEncrow. Now, this being Monday, we're offering you a summary of the sports news with Ian Willoughby.
We begin today with tennis and the news that the Czech Republic's Barbara Krejčíková and Kateřina Siniaková were beaten in the women's doubles final at the WTA Finals in Singapore on Sunday. The top-seeded pair lost 4-6, 5-7 to the Hungarian-French duo of Timea Babos and Kristina Mladenovic to miss out on what would have been the perfect ending to a fabulous season. Krejčíková said she and Siniaková might have done better on the day.
We didn't take advantage of the chances we had. Unfortunately, those girls are very good and they outplayed us. It was deserved. We've had a very decent season and so have they. They've played well together. I hope we meet them again next year and that we're the winners then.
The two Czech season was very decent indeed, including two Grand Slam titles, the French Open and Wimbledon. The pair ended the year in number one spot and earned the title WTA Doubles Team of the Year. On the singles front, Karolina Plíšková reached the semi-finals in Singapore, only to lose love 6-6-4, 6-1 to Sloane Stephens of the US. The world number 8 has ended another season without ever having won a Grand Slam tournament. Plíšková says the competition is tough at the business end of major tournaments, but her game is improving.
All of the girls are hard to play against. They return, they fight. It's hard to say if in the future I shouldn't move closer to the net. I think I've improved at the net, which I'm proud of. This week I took a lot of points at the net and it made my life a lot easier. Maybe I need a bit more patience or another plan because I'm capable of winning a set, but so far winning two doesn't work out for me.
Just ahead of Plíšková in the world rankings, at seventh is her compatriot Petra Kvitová. Though the two-time Wimbledon winner exited in the group stage in Singapore, Kvitová still says it's been a great season for her. And it's not over either. She and the rest of the Czech team will face the USA in the Davis Cup in Prague the weekend after next. That's the Davis Cup final. And finally, football. And Victoria Pilsen have returned, briefly at least, to the top of the Czech top flight. That was after a 2-1 win over Slovácko at the weekend. That put the West Bohemians 1 point ahead of Slavia Prague, who play their round 13 game against Dukla Prague on Monday evening. That's after the recording of our programme. Otherwise, that's all the sports news for today.
That was Ian Willoughby with the sports, and a reminder that you're with Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio, where it's now time for our main feature. The Batya Shoe Company built an industrial estate in England in the 1930s, and it was there that John Tusa, the Czech-born future head of the BBC World Service, grew up. Here's Ian Willoughby's guest now in this edition of One on One.
Sir John Tusa anchored top UK current affairs show Newsnight in the 1980s, before heading the BBC World Service for 7 years. Though today a member of the British establishment, he was actually born in Czechoslovakia and moved to England as a small child. That was when his father, Jan Tusa, was appointed head of UK operations of the Batya Shoe Company. Sir John was a special guest of the Ihlava Documentary Film Festival, and I first asked him there about his parents, who had been born in the days of the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
They always said they were very lucky to have the 20 years from 1918 to 1939, which they were very proud, of course, of being citizens of Czechoslovakia, and they thought it was a marvellous state as well. So that was something that they looked back on with pride and also with regret, that the things that happened to Czechoslovakia did happen.
And when exactly and how did they leave Czechoslovakia? And
they left in the first 6 months of 1939 because my father, who worked for the Batya Shoe Company in Zlin, was appointed to run the Batya Shoe Company in England. This was very fortunate when you think about it. And my father went over and he started work, and then he had to make a lot of fuss to get visas for the rest of the family. And we only came over, I think, in June of 1939. And so that was it. People always assume that we were political. Luckily, we weren't, but we were certainly very fortunate to leave when we did.
And in the management of Batya or Bata in the UK, was your dad unusual in being Czech, or were there many Czech managers there?
There were a lot of Czech managers. I always thought it rather funny that the Czechs, the Batya company, in effect, behaved or acted like colonists. They came over to teach the English how to make shoes through mass production. And so there was a core of maybe 30 or 40 senior managers who came over from Zlin, and they arrived in southeast Essex, where there was very little work, not very much skilled work either, in order, as I say, to teach the English how to make shoes in this new revolutionary manner.
And what do you recall of the estate at East Tilbury in Essex?
The peculiar thing was that, of course, it's an exact model of the architecture and the buildings in Zlin. And I always thought it was very peculiar that we left Czechoslovakia from this modernist, extraordinary place, Zlin, and we arrived in England, and did we live in somewhere that was English, a quaint village or anything like that? No, we still lived in a Czech, modernist, Central European estate. I think it took me quite a long time to get over that, and I probably only saw the joke very much later.
How did your folks deal with the adjustment to life in the UK?
I think they were probably helped by the fact that they had so many colleagues and friends who were Czech, and so they could speak Czech to them. And their best friends were almost always Czech for a long time. I think in another way, it may not have helped very much, because it meant that they couldn't come to terms and get used, so to say, to living with the English. Also, I must say that people in the area, that is southeast Essex, always thought that my parents' language and the way they spoke, because of course they spoke Czech accented English to their dying day, was really rather strange. I think that the English themselves didn't accommodate to these strange people from Czechoslovakia as well as they might have done. There was never any discrimination or anything like that. But there was always a certain distance that these Czechs were a bit different, which perhaps we were.
Did your parents ever see Czechoslovakia again?
Yes, my father many years later. My mother came back with us in 1961, us, the grown-up children, because I wanted to introduce my wife, we just got married, to my relatives and to Czechoslovakia. 1961 was very difficult, by the way. It was, you know, the depths of communist rule. The atmosphere was horrible. There was a lot of police supervision. Even when we were in my mother's hometown, Bystrice pod Hostinem in southern Moravia, the police would occasionally visit in the evening to make sure that they were there. We had to report to the police station and so on. It was not a nice atmosphere. And there were loudspeakers throughout the village which would give these instructions as to what people had to do. I don't think you could get away from the loudspeakers, probably even in the fields. It really was unpleasant. And of course, the worst thing was that our relatives said, when will NATO come and free us from these people, communism? And I remember saying, Luba, I think you must understand, that isn't going to happen. It can't happen. And I think he was heartbroken by that. So it was wonderful that we went back, but it was very, very painful, more painful for my relatives than, of course, for us, because we could leave.
As a journalist, you were involved in the early days of Newsnight. That must have been very exciting and also, I guess, a high-pressure job. You were the main presenter in the 1980s, the early 1980s. What do you recall of that time?
The wonderful thing about that programme was that it was a new programme and it dealt with news and current affairs in a different way. It integrated them into one. So it broke all sorts of rules inside the BBC. And therefore all the people who worked on it and the people who were editing it weren't interested in the old ways of dividing up the news from current affairs. And we all felt that if we had a good idea, we could put it on the screen, we could do an item about it in that evening. And that was absolutely invigorating. So it meant that everybody who worked on the programme knew they had the opportunity to be original, maybe to break the rules from time to time, and that was what was wanted. And it was an exhilarating 6 years. It really was. And we believed in humour, in irreverence, in originality, and that was a terrific atmosphere to work in.
In the mid-1980s, you became the managing director of the BBC World Service. How do you look back on that period?
It was very demanding. It was very hard work, but everybody at Bush House, which was where the BBC World Services worked from, were completely united by belief in what we were doing, and that was to give the best possible open, free, accurate information to all our listeners, the sense of dedication to the listener, wherever they were. And that feeling of we are doing the best for them, not we are broadcasting something that we're interested in, we were, but it was the listener who came first. And that was why we would fight for our independence, which was never in question, but from time to time we'd have to say to, say, the Foreign Office or to other parts of the BBC, this is us, this is why we do as we do, and we will continue to do it. And we fought very hard to maintain that independence because we knew that that was what mattered. Listeners, after all, aren't stupid, and particularly listeners who live in a closed authoritarian society. Hearing news which was accurate and which was giving them a different view of the world that was presented by their own official media, this was a high responsibility, but it was also a privilege to be able to broadcast to them in that way.
I was reading that when you were managing director of the BBC World Service that you had to, or that you chose to cultivate then Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Why did you need to do that, and how did you find her?
Well, we needed to do it. I thought it would be quite sensible, given that in the end our funding came from the government, and that she was not a friend of the BBC, by no means. Therefore, I thought it was even more important that she should know exactly what the World Service was doing, why the government funded it, and the sort of things that we did. And she was actually quite open to this, I think, because the very first invitation we gave her was to say, come and do a programme where you answer questions from listeners in the Soviet Union. And I think this really attracted her. This tickled her sense of risk, perhaps. So she came to do that. That worked well. And then about a year later, I thought, it's time to have her again. And this time, we'll make sure that we will tell her. We have time to tell her what the World Service is about. And she was a very strange... No, she wasn't a strange woman. In some respects, she was very direct. And if she decided that she liked something and admired something, that was that. She would have made up her mind, and she would stick to it. So I never had any difficulties with her. And she said she never complained about World Service coverage. Not at all. Quite the reverse.
You also headed the Barbican Arts Centre for many years. How did you find the difference between the two roles, being a manager or managing director, and journalism? Surely they require rather different skill sets.
I think actually they were very nearly exactly the same, and I'll tell you why. Because journalists and people who work in the arts are very similar. They all work because they believe in the values of the activity they're engaged in, whether it is providing the news or it is creating the best possible art. So they are all driven by this ideal and these values. They're also, nobody is in journalism or the arts to make money, because there isn't money there. So there is really belief. That alone made it very, very simple. You know, both organisations were united by this absolutely core belief in the importance of the activity we were engaged in. The best possible art mattered. The most true, accurate journalism mattered. And the people who produced those things, they were actually first cousins. So knowing how to work with them and to create an environment where they could do their best work, this was comparatively simple.
You left this country at the age of 2 or 3. How does it feel being back here today?
It's always very nice. It's always very nice. I never pretend that I am more Czech than I am. That would be foolish. But there are all sorts of aspects, I think, probably to the way, maybe even that I behave, and aspects of things that I learned from my parents, that I learned from my father, again, which I probably can't even accurately identify, but which make me, and sometimes I'm told this by English people, which make me distinctly different and probably a bit foreign. I mean, at one level, of course, I'm British and British and British, and people say member of the British establishment and so on and so forth, but a rather different one. And that is very precious to me, and probably even more precious, because after all, the Czech Republic is one of my ways back into and to remain in Europe. And being European, I'm European because I am Czech, and also because I'm British. But Czech is, as it were, the doorway into being really European.
And you were telling me you're getting Czech citizenship.
I know I'll have my Czech passport, which I will use very proudly in a matter of a few weeks. No more than that. Long before Brexit, if it ever happens. But even so, I'd want to have a Czech passport, and I'm very, very pleased that I shall have one.
John Tusa, a former head of the BBC's World Service, was Ian Willoughby's guest in this edition of One on One. And I'm afraid that's all from us for now. You'll find us at radio.cz. Should you like to contact us, then please write to english@radio.cz. We'll be happy to hear from you. And of course, you can follow Radio Prague on Facebook and Twitter. This is Daniela Zarová saying thanks for listening and take care.